This is Kirk Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, welcoming you to another edition of Did You Know?
This is Pam Vesper. We are happy to present this program, which is designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
And I'm Bob Martin, and I'm happiest of all.
Why are you so happy?
Because of my birthday.
Well, let's see, your birthday. Did you know what else happened on Bob's birthday?
What?
In 1833, the city of Chicago was incorporated as a village. In 1846, the Smithsonian Institute was established. And in 1946, Bill Clinton was born. One of those things makes you happy?
Wait a minute, Kurt. If those things happened on his birthday is August 10th. This isn't his birthday.
I know. That's why I'm so happy.
You're happy because it's not your birthday.
Unfortunately for us, you're going to have to explain that.
Well, if it's not my birthday, then what won't happen?
For one thing, you won't get a party.
And if I don't get a party, what won't we get to eat?
Ice cream and cake.
Then, if it isn't my birthday, and there's no party, if there's no party, there's no ice cream and cake. Think of all the weight I won't have to lose because of all the ice cream and cake that I didn't eat. That sure makes me happy.
Oh, speaking of Chicago being established, did you know why the city of Chicago is called the Windy City?
Well, I'd guess it would be because of the winds that are always coming in off the lake.
Well, it would seem so, but actually Chicago is not the windiest place in the U.S. According to findings of the National Climatic Data Center from 2003, the windiest city was Blue Mill, Massachusetts, which had an average annual wind speed of 15.4 miles per hour, with Dodge City, Kansas, and Amarillo, Texas coming second and third at 14 miles per hour and 13.5 miles per hour. Ahead of Chicago is number 10, Lubbock, Texas, at 12.4 miles per hour. Comparatively, Chicago pushes the needle at a slow 10.3.
Why then the title Windy City?
Well, there are a couple of suggestions, but the one I like the best is that years ago, local dignitaries used to brag excessively about their city, and two promoters especially, William Bross and John Stephen Wright, were so effusive in their praise that they were referred to as a couple of old windbags. If they were windbags, their city had to be the Windy City.
Anyway, it's my turn to segue. Speaking of the Smithsonian, they have a large display of animals in natural history, and since we haven't done much of Did You Know about animals, I thought it was about time. And since it's my idea, I'll start. I have a solution to the old conundrum. Bob, for your benefit, that's a puzzle.
I knew what it meant. It's a kind of jigsaw puzzle.
Bob, crossword puzzle.
Well, I couldn't solve it, so I took it out in the garage and used the jigsaw.
Whatever. Did you know if zebras are black with white stripes or white with black stripes?
You found an answer to that?
Yep. If you shave a zebra, you'll find the skin is black.
Well, that makes sense since they're out in the sun so much.
And the white stripes are all different, sort of like human fingerprints. And that's how zebras can help identify one another.
Did you know that polar bears are not white? The hairs that cover their bodies are actually hollow tubes that trap the sun's light and heat so it can get to the bear's skin. When the sun reflects off of these hairs, they appear white, but their actual color depends on light refraction and the season and the texture of the fur. Underneath, their skin is also black.
Did you know that panda bears really are bears?
No, wait a minute. Even though we call them panda bears, I've read that scientists believe that they are not true bears, but actually closer to the raccoon.
Well, that is true. I've read the same things. But recently, further testing, now with the help of DNA tests, have shown that panda bears are actually more closely related to Yogi Bear than to Rocky Raccoon.
Did you know that dogs actually do sweat?
Sure. That's what panting is all about.
Good point, but not totally accurate. Dogs do control body temperature by panting, but they don't actually sweat through their mouths. Rapid breathing in dogs, sometimes up to 300 or 400 breaths a minute, is the way dogs use to expend body heat. But they don't perspire like humans do, with moisture-forming droplets on the skin while reducing body heat.
But I thought you said that dogs do sweat.
Well, they do, just not through their mouths, and obviously not through the skin. The fur would interfere.
Well, how then?
Through their paws. That's why you can see pad prints on wooden decking during hot days. But the paws are not efficient enough to relieve all the temperature, so we're back to panting.
And panting is so efficient that dogs can, for instance, keep chasing rabbits for prolonged periods. While rabbits do not have the same ability, so rabbits will keep running until they drop dead.
Did you know that John Audubon probably would not be welcomed into the Audubon Society today?
Why not? It's named after him.
Simply because, to get some of his studies done, he shot the birds and then stuck wires through them to get them into certain postures.
Oh, gross.
Well, I'm sure if Audubon were alive today, with the availability of high-speed cameras, that's what he would use. Just remember, such cameras weren't available back then.
Did you know that the dolphin is the fastest sea mammal? They can travel at speeds up to 35 miles an hour.
Did you know that piranhas are not as dangerous as they are made out to be? In fact, they are quite timid creatures who fear humans more than we fear them.
How did they get the bad rap?
Did you know that you can probably blame Teddy Roosevelt? During a trip to Brazil in 1913, his hosts wanted to give him, as Ed Sullivan would say, a really big show. So, their fish expert, one Miranda Ribeiro, had a section of the river blocked off and then stocked with a group of pole-caught piranha, which they left unfed for several days. When Mr. Roosevelt was brought to this section of the river, he was warned, "Don't put your hands in the water." Roosevelt wanted proof, so an ailing cow was pushed into the river and was promptly devoured by the starving piranhas. Awestruck Roosevelt returned with a tale of aquatic terror that remains to this day.
And piranhas don't feed like that?
Now, recent photos show them darting out and snipping off parts of other fish's tail. That's all. After all, why kill the host when he'll grow a new piece of tail and come back for a second feeding?
Before we get too far away from dogs, did you know that it's an old wives' tale that dogs' mouths are cleaner than humans? I know they clean off their own wounds, but before you let Fido lick you in the face, remember where else that tongue has been.
Well, since we're still with dogs, did you know that calculating a dog's age is not as simple as multiplying by one set of numbers, say 7, as some people do? All dogs are different, and different-sized dogs age at different rates. Developmental skills vary, and generally, large breeds age faster than small breeds.
Well, how about an example?
Okay, here's a quick look from puppyhood. 1 human year equals 15 dog years. 2 human years is 24 dog years. 3 humans is 28 dogs. 4 is 32. And 5 human years equals 36 dog years.
Wow, that's sure not like saying times 7.
Of course not. Think how fast puppies learn to do something and how long humans take to learn to do something.
And as they get to older age, at 7, a Chihuahua is considered 44, but a Collie would be 50. And at 10, the little guy is 52, but a Lab would be on Social Security at age 66.
Did you know that the difference between a duck is that one of his feet is both the same?
Did you know that when geese fly in a V pattern, that shape helps them? It's aerodynamic. So the geese behind the leader have it easier than the leader. Just like drafting in NASCAR. Plus, they trade off to share the load.
Did you know that when cats purr...
Wait, just a minute. What's the difference between a duck? One of its legs is both the same?
Sorry, too late. You can't go back.
Bob, I think somebody yelled duck, and you didn't.
I think we need a story.
How about the cat's purr?
Hold that thought. Here's another nursery rhyme to explain. Ba-ba, black sheep, have you any wool? Yes, sir, 3 bags full. 1 for my master, 1 for my dame, and 1 for the little boy who lives down the lane. Ba-ba, black sheep is an early complaint about taxes. Some versions even end, and none for the little boy who lives down the lane, which seems very unfair, as the little boy represented either the farmers or the people of England.
The wealth of England was largely a result of the trade in wool, hence the wool sack on which the Lord Chancellor still sits today in the House of Lords. The wool sack was introduced by King Edward III in the 14th century, and though originally filled with English wool, it is currently packed with wool from each of the countries in the British Commonwealth in order to express unity among member states. Quite how a British lord plunking himself down on the produce of more than 50 countries symbolizes Concord is hard to say, though it does provide a good metaphor for the British Empire.
During feudal times, taxes did not go to the Chancellor or even the European Union. In the Middle Ages, farmers were required to give one-third of their income, which could be in the forms of goods such as wool, to their master, the local lord, who would then in turn pass one-third of it to the king and another third to the dame, representing the church. The final third they kept for themselves or sold, and this was the part that went to the little boy. Of course, if you really want to bleat about it, the sheep started off with all the wool and ended up with none at all.
Great story, especially coming into tax time. Speaking of collectors, here's the story about the end of one of North Carolina's famous collectors, the last fight of Blackbeard. Of the many pirates that ravaged off the coast of North Carolina during the early years of the 18th century, by far the most fearsome was Blackbeard. He had been born in England with the name of Edward Teach, or possibly Thatch or Thatch. He had grisly hair, the color of midnight, and to make himself look even more terrifying, he attached slow-burning fuses to the tufts of his beard. With the smoke and the sparkling around his face, he gave the impression that his face was about to blow up.
So fearsome was he that the governor of North Carolina, Charles Eden, didn't even try to stop him, but allowed him to roam freely along the coast. He settled briefly at his house in the town of Bath with his 13th wife, but soon was bored and was again plundering from Virginia to South Carolina. Since Governor Eden wouldn't stop him, the governor of Virginia sent Lieutenant Robert Maynard to do the job. At Ocracoke, before daylight on November 22, 1718, they met. When the ships touched, Blackbeard jumped from his ship, Adventure, onto Maynard's sloop. Maynard put a bullet through Blackbeard's body, but that didn't stop him. Blackbeard fought on until, with a mighty swish of his sword, Maynard severed Blackbeard's head from his body. The head fell into the water and circled the ship three times, calling out, "O crow, cock! O crow, cock!"
You see, the crowing of the cock signaled the beginning of the day, and Blackbeard wanted enough time for his head to find his body, but it was too late. Maynard's men counted 25 wounds to Blackbeard's body. They retrieved the head, swung it to the bowsprit of Maynard's ship, and sailed from the island. And so was the legend of Blackbeard's last fight told around campfires, even to this day.
Speaking of pirates, as fearsome as Blackbeard was, there were some other pirates that scared a lot of people. And did you know a few of them were women? Well, let's have a look. Considered the fiercest was Anne Bonny. She was born Anne O'Malley in Ireland. Eventually, her father left his wife and brought his mistress, i.e. Anne's mother, and Anne to South Carolina.
When she decided that she wanted to marry one James Bonny, her father objected, so she eloped. She quickly tired of Bonny and took up with a pirate named Calico Jack Rackham. Her temper and courage were legendary. One poor fellow once tried to rape her, and she beat him so badly that he lay ill for a considerable time. In battle she wore a man's long coat, long pants, a handkerchief wrapped around her head, a pistol in one hand and a machete in the other.
My kind of gal. In 1720, the British, determined to end the piracy, captured Captain Calico Jack's ship. Only three stayed on deck. One was Anne. Jack and the rest of the crew hid below deck. Just before he was hung, Jack visited Anne in prison, and if he expected a little sympathy, good luck. She told him that if he had fought like a man, we wouldn't be dying like a dog. She escaped hanging by pleating her belly, as it was called in those days, saying she was pregnant. But somehow she disappeared and wasn't seen again.
Next is Mary Read, who was born near London, and like Anne Bonny, illegitimate. When her father died, her mother dressed her in men's clothing, and she eventually joined the army and fought bravely until she fell in love. She and her husband left the army and became innkeepers. That might have been the end of Mary, except that her husband died, and feeling the pinch of poverty, she took up soldiering again.
At the end of her service, she sailed towards the West Indies, where the ship was taken by pirates. Did you know that the pirate ship happened to be under the command of one Captain Calico Jack? And she said if Anne Bonny could do it, so could Mary Read. She became as good a fighter as Anne, and the story is told that she fell in love with one of the other pirates, who happened to have been challenged to a duel. Not taking any chances, Mary picked a fight with the other guy, and when her beau showed up for the duel, Mary had already killed him.
When the British finally captured Calico Jack, Mary Read was one of the other two sailors still fighting alongside Anne Bonny, and as the other pirates ran away, she even fired on them in anger and disgust. She also escaped hanging by pleating her belly, but ended up dying in prison from a fever. Wouldn't the two of them have made a fun double date?
Maybe not as fighting fierce as Anne Bonny, but noted as maybe the most successful pirate was Zheng Yi Cao, born in China and raised along the South China Sea. She married a man who ran a fleet of pirate junks and decided to make it a family business. There was a lot of pirating in the area, but most of it not very successful because the pirates spent too much time fighting among themselves. Zheng Yi Cao and her husband organized them into a confederation.
When the husband died in 1807, she took over. She built up six fleets of junks that carried cannons and 400 men each. Not only did they rob ships, but they sold protection to fishermen along the way. They had warehouses full of plunder to keep them supplied, and the wealth was shared by all. And there was no funny business allowed. First-time thieves were flogged, second-time executed. Deserters lost their ears, fornicators their heads.
When the government tried to step in, she sent her crew to terrorize the government. To make their point, they even ate their enemies' hearts with rice. Finally, in 1810, she signed an agreement with the government to avoid prosecution and married again and retired. For a while. When her husband died, she got back into the gambling and smuggling business, which was a quiet life for her. And she died peacefully in 1844.
Finally, there is Grace O'Malley, born in Ireland about 1530, and apparently no relation to the Anne Bonny O'Malley from 150 years later. She also was a girl not cut out for playing with dolls. Her father was a sea captain, and she cut her hair, dressed in boys' clothing, to go to sea with her father. Good decision. Once when his ship was attacked by pirates and a pirate came up behind the good captain with a dagger, Grace stepped out of the rigging and attacked the pirate. The distraction saved O'Malley's life, and his men went on to defeat the pirates.
At 16, she was given in a political marriage to the younger leader of the O'Flaherty clan. Together, they ruled the Irish waterways off the west coast of Ireland. After 19 years of marriage, her husband Donald died defending Cork's castle. The widowed mother of three put together a band of warriors and recaptured the castle. Because of her bravery, the castle was renamed Hen's Castle, a name it still has today. She eventually remarried and moved to his home, Rockfleet Castle. She returned to the sea and controlled the waters from Cruz Island to Galway. She charged money for safe passage and plundered any ship that refused to pay. Legend has it that aboard ship, one day after the birth of her fourth child, beset by Turkish pirates, she was told they were losing. She said to the messenger, "You can't get along without me for even one day." Got up, wrapped herself in a blanket, and joined in the fight.
And she won. And then added the Turkish ship to her fleet. 1586, she was captured by Richard Bingham, who confiscated her cattle and horses, tied her up, and intended to hang her. She escaped, and in a brash move, petitioned Queen Elizabeth for justice. She faced death because Elizabeth had no sympathy for rebellious Irish chiefs. Nobody knows what passed between the two queens, but in 1593, Elizabeth ordered Bingham to pardon Grace and her family, and then ordered him to give the old lady a stipend to live on, saying she considered the Irish leader an ally who would fight in our quarrel with all the world. She commanded a fleet of ships into her 70s. And is believed to have died in 1603 in Rockfleet Castle. What a perfect ending.
Speaking of perfect, how about my cat story?
Feel proud of yourself over that segue, don't you?
Grinning like a Cheshire cat. Did you know why cats purr?
Well, I suppose because they're happy.
But not just. They seem to purr for all sorts of reasons. Purring begins at birth and is a vital form of communication between mother and kitten. Later on, they purr when they're under stress and even when they're ill. The Fauna Institute in North Carolina even found that they purr to help heal themselves from illness or injury. The one absolute is that when cats purr, the people around them feel better.
Speaking of cats, did you know that in spite of all the pretty pictures of cats with saucers of milk, that milk is not especially good for a cat? Adult cats are very much like humans. After infancy, cats and humans both often become lactose intolerant. A big bowl of milk for Tabby when he's not used to it may be gobbled up in a hurry, but could also result in a major bellyache.
And speaking of popular beliefs that aren't necessarily true, you don't carve X's in somebody's arm and suck poison out in case of snake bite. It does no good for the victim and puts the rescuer in danger. Check a good Red Cross first aid book.
Also, the myth of a mass death march of lemmings into the ocean.
Wait a minute. I've seen the movie about the lemmings. Every so many years, they get terribly overcrowded, and there is a mass march to the sea where they all go over the cliffs.
I'm sure most of us have seen that movie, and that's where the trouble started. The film you mean was entitled White Wilderness, and it was filmed by Disney. I hope you don't think that the Pinocchio he made was the identical story that Carlo Collodi wrote. The movie showed all the little animals running across the plains, over the cliffs, and into the Arctic Ocean. First problem, the film was shot in Alberta, Canada, where the lemming aren't. And also the area is landlocked, making it a long jump into the Arctic Ocean. All the little animals used in the film were imported. To give the illusion they were running across the prairie, the filmmakers took a large turntable, covered it with snow, and then filmed, basically while the lemming ran around in circles. To give the illusion of over the cliff, they ran a few over a riverbank in the water where they had a short and safe swim home.
Here's the real story behind the lemmings. It is true that they are very prolific. They can begin mating only a few weeks after they're born and can have litters of up to 13 within 3 weeks. That's a lot of lemmings. And about every 4 years, their population does reach critical mass, and there is a lot of mad dashing around looking for food. But their movements are random and crisscross, not suicidally heading for destruction.
When the population is this great, running around in the open, it attracts predators that now have a feast day. For about a year after this peak period, the predators whose population is also growing because of the plentiful food supply greatly reduce the number of lemmings. Then the whole process begins again. But sorry, no mass migration to death.
Did you know that a fellow that went up there to watch the lemmings was also an avid hunter? He went to his little cabin to get ready for the next day's hunt, had a nice sleep, and woke early the next morning ready to go. He left his cabin and walked 1 mile due south. Then he turned and he walked 1 mile east. Finally, he turned and walked 1 mile north. There, right outside his cabin door, was a bear. What color was the bear?
What color was the bear? How can we know that?
Besides that, you can't go 1 mile south, 1 mile east, and 1 mile north and end up in exactly the same place you started.
Bet you can. Remember, I told you he was up watching the lemmings.
That means he would have been up in the Arctic, so?
So if he's in the Arctic, that probably means polar bear, so that could mean the bear is white. All right, that's possible. But that doesn't answer about the directions.
Oh, yes it does. If he's at the North Pole, one south, one east, and one north, he's back at the North Pole.
I win!
Hold it. A little while ago, I told you that polar bears had black skins, and the hollow tube hairs just made them look white.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch, did you know what's the difference between possums and opossums?
No, what?
Opossums come from Ireland!
I'm more interested in pirates than possums. We tend to think of thieves as being totally without morals,
Are you about to tell us something about honor among thieves?
Of course I am. According to history, even pirates had a code of conduct. Although they had no qualms about plundering another ship, there were articles of agreement that varied from ship to ship that dictated government, division of booty, and general rules of safety and responsibility that each member of the crew had to sign before the voyage began. Violation of the contract could cause the offender to be marooned.
Do you have any examples of such rules?
Well, of course, yes. These were drawn up by Captain John Phillips for his crew aboard the Revenge. If any man shall steal anything in the company, or cheat in a game, to the value of a piece of eight, he shall be marooned or shot. That man that shall strike another whilst those articles are in force shall receive Moses' law, that is 40 stripes minus one, on his bare back. If at any time you meet a prudent woman, that man that offers to meddle with her without her consent shall suffer present death.
Hey. Back to animals. Did you know there are several locations in North Carolina that owe their origins to animals and animal folklore? There's Turkey in Sampson County. Today, any turkeys seen would probably be escapees from a turkey farm. But in old times, there were plenty of wild turkeys, especially along Turkey Creek, which runs along the northern borders of the town. And in 1877, when the railroad built a line between Warsaw and Clinton, they named the depot
Turkey. But if you wanted to go from Turkey to Thanksgiving, you'd have to go to Johnson County. That town was named after a Baptist church built there in 1899.
And don't forget about Turkey Otter Creek over in McDowell County. Great story for that name. Seems a settler and his wife moved to the sparsely settled area because of the beauty of the area. But they knew that their survival was going to depend on his trapping and hunting abilities. Well, he didn't have much luck for a while, and one day in mid-fall, he set out knowing if luck didn't change, they were going to have to move. He checked his trap by the river. It was empty. He continued on and came on a clearing with a bunch of fat turkey in it. He took careful aim and got a fat gobbler.
He started home, and coming by the river trap again, saw that now he had caught a river otter. So with a turkey over one shoulder and an otter over the other, he started home. His wife, pleased with the results, remarked, now they wouldn't have to leave since they live so close to
Turkey Otter Creek. Did you know wildcats played a prominent part in North Carolina history? So we have or had a Cat Pen Gap, a Cat Ridge in Transylvania County, Cat Pen Branch in Madison County, and in Madison County, Cat Creek rises and flows into Rabbit Creek. And Cat Square, a country crossroad in early Lincoln County, was not named for a wildcat, but a basket of hapless kittens abandoned there.
And did you know a brave dog inspired the names of Hanging Dog Creek, Hanging Dog Mountain, Hanging Dog Gap, and Hanging Dog Community in Cherokee County? Here's a story told about that. Many years ago, a terrible winter brought famine and a threat of starvation to the Cherokee people. The crops had failed, and the hunters were having a difficult time finding wild game. One hunter, named Deer Killer, was more successful than most, not on account of his prowess, but on account of his dog. That dog would hold a bear at bay until Deer Killer arrived, or he'd nose up a fat groundhog, or maybe his best trick, he could run a deer back right to where Deer Killer was waiting for him.
One day during that terrible winter, they hadn't been having much luck. They finally came across a deer, but the dog couldn't get it to run back to where Deer Killer was waiting. Rain was beginning to fall, and then right about dusk, finally the deer came in the right direction. Deer Killer shot and wounded the buck, but didn't bring him down. The injured deer headed across a swollen creek with the dog right behind him. Deer Killer saw the buck come out the other side, but no dog. Poor dog had gotten stuck in logs and branches and was just hanging there.
Deer Killer jumped into the freezing creek, freed the struggling dog, and they both made it to safety. They took off after the deer again, caught him, and brought home a fine meal and shared it with the whole starving camp. The grateful Indians decided to name all the nearby landmarks for the hanging dog that saved them.
Speaking of Indian lore, did you know there is a story about a modern tribe of Indians who elected a college graduate to be chief of the tribe? Now, he was a brilliant man, but not always about the old ways. So when it started to become winter, the people asked the new chief if it was going to be a cold winter. Not being sure, he told them to be safe, stuck in a good supply of wood. As luck would have it, he was a friend of Al Roker, the TV weatherman, so he called up Al and asked him what the predictions were. Al confirmed it was going to be a cold winter.
Well, the next week, the people asked the chief again about the weather, and he told them, more wood. It's going to be cold. Again, he calls up Al Roker and gets the same answer. Shortly after, the Indians ask the chief if they had enough wood stacked away, and again the chief told them, more wood. It's going to be a bad one. The chief again called Al to confirm, and Al answered that it was predicted to be one of the coldest winters ever. The chief asked how he could be so sure, and Al answered,
because the Indians are laying in wood like crazy.
Pam, I can't believe you said that.
Neither do I. You all are rubbing off on me.
See? You can teach a new dog old tricks.
Hey! Getting back to our place names, did you know that we can't leave this segment without a visit to Pig Basket Creek? Up in Nash County, appearing on deeds before 1760, is a place named Pig Basket Creek. There are several stories on how it got its name, but we kind of like this one.
An early settler owned a sow that gave birth to a litter of piglets out in the woods. The settler wanted to get the brood back closer to home. But doing this, with a concerned sow, a bunch of squealing piglets, and having to cross a swollen creek over a long footbridge, wasn't going to be easy.
Well, he finally hit on a solution. He'd go back home and get a big bushel basket, load the piglets in the basket, and Mama would just follow along. He thought. A good plan until he started to cross the log. That's when Mama charged. The whole bunch, Mama, babies, and settler, ended up in the creek. Well, they all got out just fine, but from then on, the creek had its name.
Did you know that the camel does not store water in its hump? The camel is a remarkable creature, able to go up to 8 days without taking in water. Its secret? The camel is able to carry the water in its bloodstream, and when it does drink, the camel can ingest over 20 gallons of water in just a few minutes. What the animal does store in its hump is fat, which is metabolized for energy, and which, when full, can weigh 80 pounds.
And did you know that the one-humped camel is called a dromedary, and the two-humped camel is called a Bactrian camel?
And did you know which kind appears on the pack of old camel cigarettes?
Did you know why a cat rubs on your leg?
Wait a minute. Which one is it?
Which one what?
Which camel is on the pack of camels?
We have no smoking in restaurants and bars now in North Carolina, so you can't smoke anyway. One.
One what?
One hump. I thought you wanted to know.
One?
That's right. One.
I was counting to 10.
Why do cats rub on your legs?
It's one way to mark territory. It lets every other cat know, stay away. This one belongs to me.
Speaking of cats, did you know that Dr. Seuss is not really a doctor? He dropped out before receiving his doctoral degree. His real name was Theodore Geisel, but while at Dartmouth, he was caught drinking in his room one night and had to resign all his extracurricular activities. Unbeknownst to the administration, he continued his editorial work under the name Seuss. He added the doctor after he graduated.
Even though he wasn't a doctor, a young fellow named Bartholomew Cubbins once brought in a sick cat to see him. Did you know it was the Cat in the Hat? And he was so sick that he turned invisible.
I never knew the Cat in the Hat had gotten sick, and I had read the book several times. All right, so what did Dr. Seuss do?
Nothing. He said he couldn't see him.
Boy, that doctor sure must have been busy.
Must have been, Bob.
Did you know that snake charmers don't really hypnotize cobras? The cobra is rather shy and tries to scare off a potential enemy by mimicking his movements. So while in training, the snake charmer will give the snake a slight tap on the head with his flute. The snake views the flute as the enemy and echoes the movement.
So this is what happens. The charmer lifts off the lid of the basket. The snake, startled by the light, lifts up to see what's happening. Then it fixes on the swaying flute and sways in retaliation. Not really much to it, but showmanship.
Even kissing the head of the snake is deceiving, since the snake lacks the ability to attack things that are above its head.
Did you know the same principle is involved with animal shows that you see at aquariums? It isn't that you teach the animals tricks.
You just watch to see what the animal does. And then you write a script around it.
Sort of like Bob.
Speaking of Bob, I knew this man who worked down in SeaWorld in San Diego, California. He spent a lot of time inside the exhibit of penguins. First of all, penguins don't really swim through the water. They fly. Watch the motion the next time you get a chance. So with a sharp snap of their tail and quick fin stroke, they're able to pop right out of the water onto the shore. They don't climb out or crawl out. They pop out.
Now, that part's true. I've seen it. 1 minute they're in the water, and the next they're standing upright on the shore.
So what happened?
So one day he's waist-deep in water, cleaning, when the penguin dives in at the other end of the pool and pops up right next to him. He reached out and picks it out of the air and then put it on the shore.
Oh, that's funny.
But wait, there's more. The penguin turned around and looked at him, then waddled down to the other end of the pool, jumped in, swam down, and did it again. From then on, it was a game.
Well, how does the snake charmer fit in?
Well, whenever he was in cleaning and saw the penguin getting ready to swim down, he'd wave at people on the outside of the glass who were watching the exhibit, then motion to them with the, "Hey, watch me!" Then he'd clap his hands together and hold them out like he was getting ready to catch something. Down would come the penguin, pop out of the water, and he'd catch him in midair. Then he'd put the penguin on one knee, put an arm around like, ta-da! The people thought it was amazing. The penguin just thought it was a game.
I think we deserve another North Carolina legend. This one is entitled The Evil Hunter of Purgatory Mountain.
In 1971, the site chosen as the location for the new North Carolina State Zoo was 900 feet high Purgatory Mountain, southeast of Asheboro in Randolph County. It is a rugged tract of dense thickets, tall trees, large rocks, and unproductive soil. How Purgatory Mountain got its name goes way back, some say, to the last years of the Civil War.
You see, that part of Randolph County was settled by peace-loving Quakers, who wanted no part of the Confederate Army. In 1864, so hard up was the South for soldiers that a rapacious recruiter called the Hunter was sent into the area to recruit any healthy males he could put his hands on. He rounded up 22 Quaker boys aged 14 or younger, tied them together, and set off to Wilmington to turn them in.
Ah, in the boys' minds there was but one thought, escape. In the confusion of Wilmington, where it was obvious that the end of the Confederacy was mere months away, the boys managed to slip away, stay out of sight, and arrive back in Randolph County. The evil hunter was still there, so instead of returning to their parents' modest homes where they knew they would be found by the hunter, they hid out on Purgatory Mountain underneath the rocks and among the dense thickets.
Even though they were schooled in their faith against killing, they had determined that the evil hunter must be done away with. From their hideaways, they observed his habits and noticed that the first thing in the morning at daybreak, he always checked his fish traps down on Richland Creek. Three of the older boys were chosen to kill him. One morning, two shots rang out, and the man fell dead beside his fish traps.
The 22 boys were sworn to secrecy, and not one of them ever repeated the names of the three boys who went out that morning or the two who fired the guns. But as they grew to manhood, they avoided hunting on Purgatory Mountain, where it is well known that the ghost of the hunter, still in purgatory, was in search of his murderers, as he still is today. If this were April 1st, did you know what happened on this date in history?
In 1957, thanks to the eradication of the deadly spaghetti weevil, Italian spaghetti farmers announced a bumper crop. The BBC carried a photograph of the farmers picking their crops from the spaghetti bushes.
In 1998, the state of Alabama announced a new value for the mathematical symbol of pi.
In 1996, Taco Bell announced that to reduce the federal deficit, they had purchased the Liberty Bell and were renaming it the Taco Liberty Bell.
In 1965, Dutch television announced that the famed Leaning Tower of Pisa had toppled over.
In 1970, the AMC Gremlin was introduced.
In 2010, there would be 275 shopping days left until Christmas. Did you know that one of those stories we just told you is true? Can you guess which one?
Did you know where the idea of April Fool's Day came from?
No one knows for sure where April Fool's Day came from, but here are three possibilities.
When the calendar was switched from Julian to Gregorian, King Charles IX of France declared that the year would now begin on January 1st. Up until 1564, the New Year celebration was held on March 25th. People who forgot the new date, or many peasants who didn't know and celebrated the old, were made fools of. Remember, if March was the first month, then September is the 7th, October the 8th, November the 9th and December the 10th. Do you know that's why the names of the months and what the Latin names mean don't line up on our present calendar?
There is an old Persian tradition dating back to 536 BCE where people celebrated a prank-playing day on April 1st or 2nd, and other peoples adopted the tradition because it was fun. And I think the Taco Bell story is the one that's true.
Another possibility came from an old belief that during the Great Flood recorded in the Bible, it was on April 1st that Noah mistakenly released the first dove to find dry land. I picked the Taco Bell story also, though I heard on TV that the spaghetti weevil really was a terrible menace.
Did you know that the GMC gremlin was a true story? And that there are 275 shopping days. Both are true.
You said only one was true.
Well, did you know that there are three kinds of people in this world?
Yes.
Those who can count.
Yes.
And those who can't.
I'm one of those, and I still believe a lot of damage was done by that spaghetti weevil.
Bob, there's no such thing as a spaghetti weevil.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, then how come there are so many macaronis that have holes in them?
Since we're dealing with children, how about another nursery rhyme explained? Here's the full text of Pop Goes the Weasel. Half a pound of tuppenny rice, half a pound of treacle. That's the way the money goes. Pop goes the weasel. Johnny's got the whooping cough and Mary's got the measles. That's the way the money goes. Pop goes the weasel. Up and down the city road, in and out the eagle. That's the way the money goes. Pop goes the weasel. A penny for a ball of thread, another for the needle. That's the way the money goes. Pop goes the weasel. All around the cobbler's bench, the monkey chased the people. The donkey thought 'twas all in fun. Pop goes the weasel. And the variant of the last verse that we're most used to is this. All around the mulberry bush, the monkey chased the weasel. The monkey thought 'twas all in fun. Pop goes the weasel.
Okay, where do we start? The pop goes the weasel probably is a spinning term and refers to the sound the spinning wheel makes as it gets to the end of the spinning cycle, where the weasel is a part of the spinning wheel, and the mulberry bush is the food source of silkworms.
When the Edict of Nantes, which guaranteed religious freedom, was revoked in 1685, many immigrants fled France. A large number of silk makers settled in the area of Spitalfields in East London. Subsequent immigrations included Jewish merchants. Many of them also were involved in what was termed the rag trade. Thus, the spinning wheel reference. By the 1850s, the most popular form of entertainment in the East End was the music halls. The early verses, and many more like them, bled from the music halls onto the streets, where they became a parody on how the poor spent their money.
In East End rhyming slang, monkey tails were nails, just as monkey wrench was bench, fitting into a workplace motif. Also, weasel was anything silver like watches, and pop off meant to pawn something. So part of the amusement of the music hall were skits about the poor, spending their money and then finding something to pawn so they could be off again to the Eagle, a public house or today's pub. So, pop goes the weasel.
Are you sure it wasn't the sound of a weevil making holes in spaghetti?
What?
Never mind. Mark that one up for us.
Speaking of Mark, do you know how Samuel Clemens got his popular name, Mark Twain?
No, tell us.
Well, as a boy, he loved the Mississippi River and dreamed of becoming a riverboat pilot, which he eventually did. One of the crew was always sounding the river, that is, checking its depth to make sure the boat was safe. A sounding line with knots on it to tell depth was dropped over the side with a mark equaling 6 feet, or 1 fathom. Twain was an old term for two. Safe water was 2 fathoms, so you wanted to hear the lineman cry, "By the mark, Twain!" He left the river in 1861 when the Civil War curtailed river traffic and traveled to Virginia City, San Francisco, and then Sacramento. And one of his favorite stories was The Celebrated Frog of Calaveras County.
You know, speaking of riverboats, I got to thinking about the expressions we use that come from riverboats.
Such as, do you know that on early riverboats, all the passenger cabins were identified, not by a number, but by the name of a state? So you got on board and went to the California room, or the Colorado room, or whatever. So cabins on ships came to be known as...
Da-da-da-da! State rooms!
Right!
Okay, how about this one? Did you know that the smokestacks could be tilted over, or otherwise you couldn't get under the bridges over the river? So when you came to an obstruction over the river and the smokestacks wouldn't fit, if they were left up straight, they tilted over. So you had to...
bend a little?
Or give a little.
Okay. Passengers on riverboats pay differently, so first-class passengers always receive better treatment.
Just like now.
Yes, just like now. One of their amenities was that they got to sit way up high on the upper deck where they had the best view.
No, no, wait a minute. Now, that could be a problem.
Why's that?
Because of the smokestacks. All that soot and ash would fall straight down, and the first-class passengers wouldn't like it, and their women were in their nice white clothes and hats wouldn't like it either, now would they?
No, they wouldn't. So to correct the problem, the big passenger boats made the smokestacks higher and put metal mesh around the top of the stack that acted like spark arresters do on modern fireplaces. This mesh was called fluting. So when the boat came down the river, often you couldn't see it because of the trees, but you could see those fancy smokestacks. You knew it was a luxury boat because...
she was well stacked.
And highfalutin.
One last one that was more common with European travelers. The well-heeled passengers could specify they wanted their staterooms on one side of the boat going out and the other side coming home to keep the sunlight out of the eyes. So their tickets were marked POSH. That's posh, which means...
no idea.
What?
Port out, starboard home.
Now, I have a cruise ship story for you. This is an official naval document from the log of the USS Constitution. On August 23, 1779, the U.S. Constitution set sail from Boston with the following items aboard: 48,600 gallons of fresh water, 7,400 cannon shot, 11,600 pounds of black powder, and 79,400 gallons of rum. Her mission was to destroy and harass English shipping. Making Jamaica on 6 October, she took on 826 pounds of flour and 68,300 gallons of rum. She then headed for the Azores, arriving there 12 November. She provisioned with 550 pounds of beef and 64,300 gallons of Portuguese wine. On 18 November, she set sail for England. In the ensuing days, she defeated 5 British men in war and captured and scuttled 12 English merchantmen, salvaging only their rum. By 27 January, her powder and shot were exhausted. Unarmed, she made a raid up the Firth of Clyde. Her landing party captured a whiskey distillery and transferred 40,000 gallons aboard by dawn. Then she headed home. The Constitution arrived in Boston Harbor on 20 February, 1780. With no cannon shot, no powder, no food, no rum, no whiskey, but the same 48,600 gallons of stagnant water.
Now that's what I call fighting spirit.
Do you know about the Winchester curse?
Anything to do with a rifle?
Yes, but not in the way you think. In 1858, Sarah Pardee married William Winchester, heir to the Winchester rifle fortune. When her husband and infant daughter died a few years later, she became convinced that she was being haunted by the ghosts of people who were killed by the Winchester rifle, especially Indians. She consulted a medium in Boston who told her that the only way to escape it would be if she built a home for the spirits. However, the construction on the house had to go on forever, day and night. If construction ceased, she would die. Since Sarah had a $20 million fortune, she bought an 8-room farmhouse near San Jose, California. For 38 years, the building went on day and night. 160 rooms, 2,000 doors, 10,000 windows, 40 staircases, some of which went nowhere, and 6 kitchens. Construction went on until 1923, when she died at age 81. Today, the house is a tourist attraction called the Mystery House.
Did you know about the preacher stuck in the ivory tower?
Wasn't that Oral Roberts?
Yes, here's the story.
Mm.
In 1982, Oral Roberts, with a then $500 million evangelical empire, built a medical center called City of Faith. It was a financial disaster. By 1987, it was draining the rest of his empire, and that's when he heard from God. He claimed God told him that at the beginning of January that he had to raise $8 million by the end of March, or he would die. Roberts put it this way, "The Lord told me, I'll call you home." His followers responded by contributing over $6.3 million, but apparently that wasn't enough for the Lord. Roberts beseeched his followers for more, and even with an extension from God, they were short. Finally, a Florida millionaire named Jerry Collins gave the final $1.3 million and also gave some advice. "I think Roberts needs some psychiatric treatment."
Finally, how about some germ warfare?
Now, that's got to be Howard Hughes.
Yes, it does.
In the 1960s, Hughes was one of the wealthiest men in America.
And some think also one of the craziest.
That too. Haunted by the early deaths of his parents, he became convinced that the only way to save himself was to protect himself from germs. He'd wrap his hands in Kleenex before he'd touch anything. When he married Jean Peters in 1957, he insisted on separate kitchens so she couldn't touch his food. Later, he wouldn't even let his physician touch him, making the doctor do an examination from the opposite side of the room. By the end of his life, he moved from hotel to hotel, taking over an entire floor, sealing all the windows and removing all the furniture except a single bed and chair. But in the end...
the germs won.
Yep.
Do you know that there are some words in the English language that mean two entirely different things?
Sure, like bear, B-A-R-E, and bear, B-E-A-R. Pear, P-E-A-R, and pear, P-E-A-R, and pear, P-A-R. Like that.
No, I mean the exact same spelling, but the word means one thing, but also the exact opposite. One book calls them schizophrenic words.
I'm not so sure about that. Give me an example.
Okay. Dust.
Dust? It's what you do to furniture. You wipe off a layer of dirt.
Right. But what do you do from an airplane? Crop dusting. What are you taking off?
I see what you mean. You're putting a layer on.
Right. And what about sanction?
That's when a group or a whole country does something you disapprove of and you restrict them in some way, like prohibitions.
Well, what if a sports group okays a certain kind of competition?
Right. It becomes an officially sanctioned event. It's approved.
And cleave?
Yeah. It can mean binding together, like a husband and wife cleave together, inseparable.
Ah, but it could also mean separate. Like what happens to wood when you take an axe to it?
Separate.
And dress.
You put clothing on.
Unless you dress a chicken, where you pull the feathers off.
Or what about trim? You have the butcher cut off all the extra fat from the steak.
But you put decorations on the Christmas tree.
I have one more. Trip.
Now, wait a minute. I only know one meaning for trip. You stumble over something or your own feet. It means you're clumsy.
Are you sure that's all?
Absolutely.
Boys and girls together, me and Mamie O'Rourke, we trip the light fantastic on
the sidewalks of New York.
How about that?
Terrible.
Speaking about at one time, do you remember as a kid riding down the highway and seeing those advertising signs with the funny little poems on them?
And do you know that we probably remember a few of them?
Okay, me first. Car in ditch, driver in tree, moon was full, so was he.
Burma shave.
Do you know those signs were posted about 100 feet apart and were meant to be read at speeds between 30 and 40 miles per hour? Anything faster than that, it was just a blur. So this is the one I remember. Slow down, Pa. Sakes alive. Mom missed signs 4 and 5.
Burma shave. My turn. Ben met Anna, made a hit, neglected beard. Ben Anna split.
Burma shave. And how about this one? If harmony is what you crave, get a tuba.
Burma shave. All right, I saved the best one till last. My job is keeping faces clean, and no one knows the stubble I've seen. Speaking of riding, do you know I've sure gotten old?
Yep.
I've had 2 bypass surgeries, a hip replacement, fought prostate and diabetes. I'm half blind. I can't hear anything quieter than a jet engine. I take 40 different medications that make me dizzy, winded, and subject to blackouts. I have bouts with dementia, have poor circulation, can't feel my hands or feet anymore. I can't remember if I'm 85 or 91. I've lost all my friends, but thank God I still have my driver's license.
Burma shave. Those are fun signs.
I'll say I'm into that.
Oh, God, grant me the senility to forget the people I never liked anyway, the good fortune to run into the ones I do, and the eyesight to tell the difference. Amen.
Burma shave.
Let's see here. Some of our...
Speaking of famous names...
Wait a minute. Who was speaking of famous names?
At least you were thinking about them.
So?
So, thinking about famous names, do you know there are certain well-known items or practices that come from the name of the person that inspired them?
This shouldn't be too hard. Let's go.
Okay. A French physician, moved by mercy, thought that hanging was a cruel method of dispatching criminals, so instead he advocated this device.
The guillotine?
Not invented by, but endorsed by Dr. Guillotine, and subsequently named after him.
I got one. A French acrobat who designed and introduced a tight-fitting costume for performance.
Leotards?
Right, Jules Léotard.
Ah.
An outspoken 19th-century feminist who objected to tight-fitting corsets and cumbersome hoop skirts, who advocated women wearing a ruffled, legged undergarment.
Bloomers.
Yes, Amelia Jenks Bloomer.
Easy one. A Swiss hotelier who founded a chain of fancy hotels and named them after himself.
Putting on the Ritz.
Caesar Ritz.
The French ambassador to Portugal in the 1550s, who first brought tobacco to France. When a certain substance was discovered in the leaves in 1818, they named it after him.
Tar?
I don't think so. How about nicotine?
Yes, Jean Nicot.
A food faddist of the early 1800s. He advocated vegetarianism and came up with a whole grain meal out of which he used to make crackers. And local YMCAs in New York used to feed them to the young teenage boys, believing the brand would decrease their raging hormones.
Crackers? Not saltines.
No.
Graham crackers.
Yes. Sylvester Graham.
That's why my mother was always feeding me Graham crackers.
Are you still eating them?
You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program has been designed for a print and visually impaired audience. This is Kurt Benrood.
And Pam Vesper.
And this is Bob Martin. We would like to thank WRAL.com, a part of the Raleigh-based Capital Broadcasting Company's new media group, for their continued support.
Goodbye.